everybody. Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by CarParts.com. CarParts.com is the best place to buy car parts on the internet. I have used it to buy parts for actually my Japanese imported Mitsubishi Delica, because there's some crossover parts with US spec. And Zach, of course, as you've been hearing for the last many weeks, has bought parts for his BMW M3. So whether you need maintenance, whether you're doing a project car, whether you're upgrading your car, doing a restoration, or just getting to work, CarParts.com has got the best selection of parts at the best available prices on the internet. Go to CarParts.com/thesmokingtire. 10% off is your deal at CarParts.com/thesmokingtire. They have been sponsoring us for several months now. We couldn't appreciate their support any more than we do. And although Zach can't be here to do his part because he's off camping this weekend, I can say CarParts.com/thesmokingtire. The best parts, the best prices. Just go there, and we got 10% off for you for using our link and supporting the people who support this show. CarParts.com/thesmokingtire. And, of course, you want to protect that car? You need security. Security, people. That's why Blackview is here with the DR750X 2-channel LTE Plus dash cam. It comes with an all-new Blackview SIM card, which means you can easily connect your dash cam to the cloud straight out of the box. The dual-channel Blackview DR750X 2-channel comes with both front and rear cameras, so you can enjoy clear image quality day and night thanks to the full HD Sony Starvis image sensors at a wide 139-degree viewing angle. Blackview's LTE dash cam is what you really need if you're considering a cloud-connected dash cam. It comes with a free Blackview app, allowing you to connect to your dash cam directly over the cloud, get impact notifications, download videos to your mobile device, watch live view, and more. The Blackview SIM card, now included with the North American version of the dash cam, is all you need to connect to Blackview Cloud. The SIM card automatically activates upon powering after insertion into the built-in SIM reader. Pick a data plan via the Blackview app and get 1 month for free. And for the ultimate peace of mind when you're away from your car, pair your cloud-connected dash cam with a parking mode accessory. Blackview automatically switches to parking mode to monitor your parked vehicle. Thanks to the video buffer, the few seconds leading to triggering events are also recorded. When paired with Blackview Cloud, parking mode lets your dash cam save event videos to the cloud in real time as they happen. I love these dash cams. I have recommended them to so many people. I've used them in my own car. They're really high quality. They look good on the windshield, and they give you peace of mind not only when you're driving, but when you leave your car parked, when it goes to service, when you let someone else borrow it, anything. It's full peace of mind. So go to blackview.com/TST to learn more about the Blackview DR750X 2-channel LTE Plus and the Blackview SIM card. That's BLACKVUE, blackview.com/TST. And then use promo code TIRE to get 10% off any Blackview dash cam with free shipping over order for orders over $200. BlackviewVUE.com/TST and then code TIRE gets you 10% off anything on the Blackview site. We're also brought to you today by HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. You can skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. The ingredients travel from the farm to your doorstep in under a week, so they always arrive fresh. No trips to the grocery store or the farmer's market. It's all about convenience, right? So not only are these ingredients fresh, they're pre-portioned, so you're not overbuying or wasting food. You don't even have to measure. The exact amount that you need is right there. You just open the little thing and pour it in when it's time to pour it in. So you don't even have to get your like measuring cups and measuring spoons dirty. It's easy to get filling meals on the table in a snap with options like family-friendly or quick and easy recipes. You can pick your favorites from 50 different weekly options, skip weeks when you need to, change your delivery date or update your preferences on the website or in the HelloFresh app. You can even customize your favorite dishes with their new Hello Custom offerings by swapping out one protein or side for another, upgrading for a more luxe experience, or even adding proteins to vegetarian meal options. That means more choices, more variety, and more meals tailored truly to you. I love HelloFresh because I love to cook. I do like to make fresh food in my kitchen. I like the act of cooking, but going to the grocery store can be a waste of time. It's annoying. I never really know what to make, and so having something out there that allows me to choose from some options easily, give me a nice, clean, easy-to-read recipe card, and then I don't have to overbuy spices or ingredients, and then end up with a bunch of leftover ingredients that get thrown away, you know, a week later, right? So with HelloFresh, I get the exact right amount of food for these recipes. Plus, I can save the recipe card. And if I ever want to make it for more people later, like for a party or something, I've got that recipe to go. Saves me time and it saves waste in my kitchen, clogging up my fridge. So go to HelloFresh.com/SmokingTire16 and then use code SMOKINGTIRE16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. HelloFresh.com/SMOKINGTIRE16 and use code SMOKINGTIRE16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. And of course, we're always brought to you by Off the Record. Off the Record is a service that helps keep those pesky points off of your record. We all like to drive in a spirited manner, and sometimes the enforcement can be a little overbearing. Not to worry. Don't plead guilty. If you get a ticket, call Off the Record. They have an amazing track record of getting those points off your record by fighting those tickets within the letter of the law. They have an amazing winning percentage, and they have a money-back guarantee. If they can't keep the points off your record, you don't pay. So go to offtherecord.com/TST or use code TST10 on the Off the Record app. You can download that app and just have it on your phone ready to go. You don't have to pay anything until you need it. Just get the app, the Off the Record app, and just have it on your phone. That way, you know if you get pulled over, if you get stopped, if you get ticketed, you have an attorney or a lot of attorney, a team of attorneys ready to go to battle for you. Offtherecord.com/TST or use code TST10 on the Off the Record app. Off the Record, because friends don't let friends plead guilty. Go to offtherecord.com/TST or code TST10 in the Off the Record app. On this week's episode, we are in Newport, Rhode Island, where Zach and I have just completed the Audrain Motor Museum. They did what's called a veteran run, and that means it has nothing to do with the military. That is when cars that are older, 1907 or older, drive in a prescribed route and back. It's a little harder than it sounds. Zach and I drove a 1902 Packard in this event, and we've got our guest Donald Osborne from the Audrain Museum. We love Donald. He's such a G, and he's a great guy. He knows everything about cars. He out-nerds us by a lot. We love his outfits, and we actually recorded this one from the Audrain Museum in front of a live studio audience for the first time ever. Hope that this can become more of a thing. And so we had no technical difficulties, but it was a good first run through for live in front of the studio audience with Donald Osborne from the Audrain Museum. It's the Smoking Tire Podcast. Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast, live in front of a studio audience for the first time ever. Yay. I've never had applause.
And of
it's
course,
first time I've ever heard applause.
Well, Matt, understanding also the rules of a studio audience, when the applause sign comes on, applaud.
Yes. Zach, do we have an applause sign?
No.
No.
Oh, well, there you
go. Donald Osborne is in the house. That's when you applaud. Thank you.
And based on the number of people that came up to me during the veteran run and said they were fans and the age of those people, I'm surprised at how young this group of folks is here. I was expecting, no, yeah, you're here too. You're here too, Bob. But I was expecting that it was going to be like, you know, early bird special at the seniors' home. And here we are. And the Audrain media team did a really nice job with our studio construction here.
The atmospheric lighting, they're specialists in that.
It's brilliant.
I can almost see my hand.
We wanted to make it dim so the seniors would trip.
Ah, that's it. I see. Yes, exactly.
No, this is cool, man. I'm excited to be back in Newport. I'm excited to be hanging out with you, Donald. I'm excited to see if our show works in front of an audience, and maybe we could do it again sometimes. But we really came out here to drive ancient cars.
Indeed.
Veteran cars, as it were.
And did you have a marvelous veteran car time?
It was awesome. It was awesome. It was so fun. You put us in a 1902 Packard, which, as I spoke about in the video we made of our car, was built 7 years before my grandfather was born. It was a really interesting experience. It took us 2.5 hours to go 19.2 miles. Which is like New York City traffic pace, basically.
Precisely, exactly.
Yeah, that's how long it takes me to go to dinner in Los Angeles on Fridays. and there is a, you know, what was it was 1901 to
1909.
Right, and it wasn't supposed to be 1909, right?
1907, there was a little, 1907 was the original cutoff, and a couple of entrants came to us and said, well, you know, I've got a 1906 this, and I've got a 1907 that, but I really love to bring my 1909 because we can fit everybody in it. Of course, they really wanted to bring the 1909 because
it was fast. Exactly. It was fast. The 1909 cars didn't seat 8 people. They were like race cars. They were fast. So your event, Veteran Run, Audrain Museum Veteran Run, what's the full title?
The full title is the Audrain Motorsport Newport Bristol Newport Veteran Car Tour.
We're going to have to work on that. That's too many words. No one's going to remember that.
What's the acronym of that?
The AMNBNT.
We got to work on that.
Which actually is the sound that the motors make.
Some of them.
It is. When they're running smoothly. Ours went Our car ran at about, so it was running perfectly for 3 blocks. We pulled out of Ochre Court. Beautiful Victorian, perfect setting. The picture of me like baroning in front of the car was, I mean, amazing. It was worth the whole trip for that shot. It ran perfectly for 3 blocks, and then out of nowhere, the car would only idle. That was it. And granted, idling in this car is like 150 RPM, and redline is 800 RPM.
So
right?
It's not that far.
It's like
in
a steamship scale, and it's a single cylinder with a massive, like a 6-inch bore on this single cylinder,
and a nice size flywheel as well.
Yeah. So we made it at idle. Of course, asterisk Zach and Ian and Ben. Ian was our riding mechanic. Ben was our tour guide, basically.
Concierge,
yes, the Audrain concierge. They had to get out and help push up hills.
Which is common on veteran car tours.
I know. That made them feel a lot better about their task.
Hills,
exactly. Don't worry.
To define hills, anything with like a 1 degree slope or steeper.
I mean, yeah.
You know.
Like there were hills, hills that in a regular car are just not hills.
Well, one of the things that was pointed out to me by veteran car enthusiasts and very experienced veteran car people is that driving a veteran car is like riding a bicycle.
Yeah.
You notice every change in elevation. In a modern car, you can drive down the road and you actually don't know often whether you're going uphill or downhill.
Right.
You have no idea the sensation of elevation at all.
And it doesn't matter. It matters now. Like when I go to a new racetrack and I walk the track, that's mm-hmm. the same way. You know all the little bit of, you know.
Right.
And this is the same deal. When you have 1 horsepower to work with, because that's about what our car would make at idle. You know, we went up hills at 2.5 to 3 miles an hour. And at one point going downhill, we saw 26 miles an hour.
Ah, very good.
Which was shady.
So scary.
I mean, really, really, all four of us thought we might die. Are these wheels really made of wood? How old are they? Why is there 20 degrees of play in the steering? And when I hit red line in third gear and have no brakes, what do I do? All of those thoughts went into my head in order on one hill.
Well, that's one of the other things, too. The fact that people talk about the experience in driving and experiencing what a car is doing. A veteran car sharpens all of that. You cannot sort of cruise around and sort of tune out when you're driving a veteran car or even riding in a veteran car. You're aware of everything that's happening all the time, which I love.
I couldn't even take one hand off the steering wheel to put my hat back on. I had to have Zach put a hat on my head like I was a baby because I said, if I take my hand off the wheel to do this, we're going in a ditch.
Think about this, however. In 1902, the motor car was still very much the plaything of the ultra wealthy. You simply
had
your
man
put your hat on as one would.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really think that this kind of event and driving these old cars, it's a totally unique way to connect with history that's like separate from just seeing it in a museum or whatever.
You're driving a 120-year-old car.
Right. And the fact that you're doing it mixed with new cars, that's when you really are like, wow, we have come a long way and thank the baby Jesus that we have. You know, but I was surprised at how the city of Newport, which is not a place that present company excluded, one might typically associate with cars. I think Newport, I think sailing and boats. But, you know, with the Concours last year, you demonstrated, all of you guys, that Newport has a really, really awesome car culture. But even like the regular folks in their Toyota RAV4s, 99.9% of them had no problem with me blocking half of a lane at 3 miles an hour for 2 hours.
That's one of the things that is really so amazing about this area. First of all, to sort of take another approach to it, Newport and Rhode Island, of course, is central to the history of the car. I mean, Willie K. Vanderbilt, the first circuit race in the country was held in Cranston in 1902.
That's his car, right?
Isn't that that's a Willie K. Vanderbilt's 1907 Renault there. And actually, that's also a Vanderbilt family coat next to it as well.
The horse-drawn coat, yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, cars were always a part. Actually, the first traffic arrest that led to a jail term was here in Newport in 1904.
Really?
A speeding infraction.
7 and a 3?
Exactly.
So it was probably something like that, wasn't it?
I think he was going...
it's a reckless. 7 and a 3.
I think he's going 10 and a walking,
ten and a walking.
So it's like, that's absolutely out of the question.
I had a friend get a reckless, I swear to God, for doing 30 and a 10. And it was a misdemeanor.
Oh, my God.
In Colorado. He had a court appearance. 30 and a 10.
Had he been going 40, they would have seized his car.
Yeah.
But the other part of it is, you were talking about the reaction of people on the road. And that's one of the things that is really so incredibly heartening to us. Since our first Concours and Motor Week in 2019 and all the events that we've done, this city and the area has really embraced it. We have stopped traffic for a good reason and with permission time after time, and everyone just stops. No one honks their horn. They all pick up their phones, take pictures. It's fantastic. I mean, people really love seeing what it is that we're doing here and seeing old cars out.
It wasn't until we tried to cross the bridge. That was when, the Mount Hope Bridge.
Exactly.
One lane each way, and I put the photo on my Instagram. I showed you that photo
last night.
The photo is incredible. I'm having it printed the size of that garage door for my office. and you know, I'm a very courteous driver, despite my reputation for going quickly in remote parts of the country. But yesterday, I spent 80% of my time in the shoulder with one wheel practically in the dirt, making room for people to go around us and holding up surprisingly little traffic. But then we got to the bridge. And as you approach this bridge in a car like this that was not running optimally, and we knew the bridge was so big.
The bridge probably looked like Mount Everest.
It's huge.
Oh, it's perfectly named for what we were doing. Man, I hope we make it up this.
Hope springs
and
eternal.
It was the biggest hill of the day.
It's one lane each way. There is no shoulder. There is no, basically not even a sidewalk. I don't even know if you're allowed to walk.
No, there's not. You cannot walk across the bridge. No.
And so I didn't want to cause a traffic jam. We certainly didn't, but what choice did we have? We had to get over the bridge. And so we crossed this bridge at two miles an hour. And the line of cars, it was actually over 100 Boston, cars. I believe. It was the whole span of the bridge.
Oh, yeah. And to the light before the bridge. Absolutely. It was amazing. It was great.
It was so bad. I felt horrible. I was like having a panic attack. If the car died on that bridge, I don't even know what the option would have
Your
been.
Your men would have pushed it, yes, sir.
Exactly. as one's men do when one's motor car needs to be assisted up a hill. We also, of course, in addition to having the wonderful appreciation of the local populace, we also have a great relationship with the Rhode Island State Police, which also assisted us.
They weren't there. I didn't see
them. Also assisted us with the event. Well, I think they probably had already cleared had more everyone to worry else about. In the event at yeah. that point. But
people were having dessert by the time we showed up to lunch. But that notwithstanding, I still want to do it again. Like, excellent. I do want to do it again.
You're invited back.
It was
in front of a studio audience.
On the record. It was 2.5 hours of real adventure. Ian, our riding mechanic, we never stopped. You know, we even like we had not even left we hadn't even gotten to the Audrain yet. And it was like, this car is not healthy.
We hadn't made it a block.
We hadn't made it. That's true. We had not made it a block.
We turned left and went, this is not how it ran earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Donald flew by and went, mom, mom, on his like, on his Daffy Duck horn, on his Oldsmobile, mom, mom, see you at lunch, guys.
I thought, well, they've got to be right behind us. They'll pass us shortly.
Right. Yes. You know. We thought that could have happened at absolutely. Any time. Yeah. But we decided that we would not stop until the car determined that we were going to stop. If it was moving, we were going.
And that's the entire point. Again, I come back to, it's an adventure. I mean, you can get into any sort of a modern high-performance car and drive across the country. Who cares?
Well, like 27 cars started, right?
Yes.
But I think 9 or 10 didn't even make it to lunch.
Let me put this in the correct way. The operators and passengers of every one of the cars made it to lunch.
You should write an auction catalog.
That is.
and several of the cars that failed to proceed during the trip up to Bristol were able to be repaired for the trip back.
True.
Some people elected not to do it.
Fair.
But
car's 120 years old. Anything can be fixed. It's never totaled. But
which is the other point of veteran car motoring. I mean, everything you need to fix every one of these cars is basically a screwdriver, a hammer, and a pair of pliers.
And a jack, which we didn't have.
And a specially made milled part if a part fails, depending.
Well,
that's the thing. They are very, very simple, and a lot of the parts and things that hold them together are like just simple. You could take them off with very simple tools. But if a housing for a valve cracks, where do you find that housing? Like O'Reilly's doesn't have it. The junk, you know, Pick and Pull doesn't have it.
You stop at the local blacksmith, he just whips one up for you.
But once we passed our first broken down car, which these people did get going again. The their license plate started with a T. It was something.
The St. Louis,
yeah,
the Timken car,
yeah, Timken, yeah, yes. Yeah. They were broken down and they did get going again. But once we passed them, and we were like, well, we're not last.
You're
now.
Not last.
We're not. We're as long as we're not last, we're going. And Ian, because you can access the engine basically from the floor of the back seat. Mm-hmm. He took off the panel and he was wrenching on the car while we were driving. He had it's a chain drive.
By the way, Ian is about 6'1 or so.
6'1, no jacket.
Yeah.
This dude had a flannel shirt with his sleeves rolled up, and he's wrenching on this engine. It's like spitting oil in his face. He's like adjusting the carb and doing all this stuff like while we were driving. At one point, we were going so slow, he had to adjust something. He got out of the car and was wrenching on it while walking behind it as we were going up a hill. And interestingly enough, so the problem with the car is if I gave it gas with a pedal, it would die.
It would fly.
But if I just let it idle without my foot on the gas, it would actually run okay. It wouldn't make power, but it would run really smooth. So it was.
So he was operating probably through the access compartment, the Advance, and the Spark.
Yeah, and he was just like messing with stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, we did get there. It was amazing. But this car was part of the Audrain collection.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you have a few veteran cars in the collection, right?
Many.
Five or six out, right?
Actually, about 12 pre-World War One cars.
So
from an 1899, actually, the earliest is an 1886 Benz Patton Motorwagen replica, and then an 1899 Crouch steam car. And
Stanley Steamer that came out yesterday was amazing.
Stanley Steamer Vanderbilt Cup Racer.
It was, it ran beautifully. I mean, it sounded like it was really dialed in. It has a steam whistle on it.
Yeah.
It sounds like the Titanic's leaving the dock.
Well, you also talked about speed, and Tom LaFerry, who owns it, was asked, you know, well, how fast can this go? He said, much faster than I'm willing to drive it.
Yeah. Jay drives his. He's got one. Yeah. He drives it real fast.
Absolutely.
But it has a boiler,
mm-hmm.
right, that is on kerosene or something,
yes,
right?
Kerosene fire.
So it has a fire going underneath it all the time. You start it in the morning and you leave the fire on all day. And when the water in the boiler gets hot enough and is ready to use, it has a little whistle like a tea kettle.
So no, you're done.
So it's sitting there at lunch going just for like an hour, because you don't turn it off, because it would take like an hour to start it again.
And of course, that's one of the great things about steam cars, the fact that in the early days of motoring, when steam, electric, and the internal combustion gasoline engine were fighting it out, the devotees of electric and steam said, do you want to sit on top of explosions in one of those internal combustion four cycle cars? No, who wants that?
They had a point. It's sketchy. Even Jay says it's sketchy. Jay is the king of sketchy. And he's like, yeah, you're doing 100 miles an hour. The thing's on fire. Even if it's going well, it's on fire. And he's got a point, you know. But watching that stuff run was just really incredible. And the outfits, the best. Everyone dresses like Donald for a day.
Exactly.
Donald wore his gym clothes.
He was, as you mentioned, I think you said it was the most casual you'd ever seen me dress.
It was. I'm like,
but that's the other thing, which is so great too, is to get into the entire spirit. You know, you're not going to put on a pair of sweatpants and an old T-shirt
unless you're Wayne Carini. Wayne Carini did not have an outfit.
He did. He sort of did. He had a jacket.
He did.
He had a long canvas jacket.
Oh, I didn't
jacket.
See the coat. I just saw him in like jacket. Like an OSU sweatshirt and sneakers.
Yeah, that's before he put his jacket
okay,
on.
Okay, all right. Wayne.
He was doing, I think he had gone over to do the London to Brighton, and he needed a jacket. So that was the jacket he had done the London to Brighton in. So
it's, the gentleman in the fur coat.
Ah,
that
yes,
was
another
that
Oldsmobiler.
Was hilarious. Curve dash Olds Tiller fur coat.
Fabulous raccoon.
Is that
coat.
Bob? Is that his name? Shout out to Bob.
Yeah, absolutely. And, he's amazing. He and his wife. They
and
were
the
there.
Dude in the Pierce who was like straight out of like World War One.
Oh
the
yeah,
sideburns.
Ben. Yeah, with his
that
great,
guy. That guy was great too. Yeah. That guy was awesome.
Feel silly dressed up.
I felt so cool.
Exactly.
I felt like the coolest I've ever felt dressed in that thing.
When
I
went to like that to drive your Porsche.
I went to the coffee shop and like at 5 a.m. before it started to get coffee and donuts for the guys at the shop, and I'm wearing that outfit, and the guy at the coffee shop looked at me like, on your way somewhere, sir.
Or
like,
on your way from somewhere, sir.
Yeah.
just getting in from a nice night out.
I forgot what we were wearing, and I turned around to carry this stuff out, and a guy walked in to buy donuts, and he just squinted at me, and I was like, what's this guy's problem? I went,
right.
I'm wearing all of this.
We're steampunk.
Yeah, I look like I'm about to clean a chimney.
Yeah. But then, you know, after our experience, when it was over, Donald took me for a ride in the Curve Dash Olds, which was like a speedster compared to our car. And he's driving this thing at the speed of regular cars. Like, other than being cold, he gave up nothing to do this. This was like, we're just driving to the store, like, no big deal. This thing was, like, beautifully smooth.
It was amazing. A single cylinder again, but absolutely amazingly smooth and great speed. Of course, it weighs nothing. And the tiller steering, which the first time I drove the Curve Dash Olds, I drove it on a country road down in Virginia that was heavily crowned, and I swore the car was possessed and wanted to kill me.
Yeah.
It's going to throw me off at every moment. And I was shooting a video, So I'm driving this while speaking and narrating a video. Yes, I'm driving along in this car and I'm driving along in this car and I think, but you know, to drive it on these streets was actually absolutely fantastic. We pull the hills with absolute ease.
What speed could you attain over the bridge?
Well, based on what we did on the hill going up Purgatory Road, we pulled Purgatory Road coming back into town, the steeper side. We were at 17 miles per hour at the top of that hill. So like, we did probably 15 miles per hour or so on the bridge.
That's like a real achievement for a car like this. It's really good. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I learned, like you just mentioned, shooting a video, because we were shooting a video, that, you know, I'm nobody special, but I have one skill, and that's the ability to, when in a normal car, completely divorce my hands and feet from my brain.
Right.
Don't need them.
Right.
I can be on a racetrack and talk about the trunk space or the weather or anything unrelated to what I'm doing. Not in this car. In this car, I'm only able to speak about the things happening right here, right now, and I cannot. And so the video, you know, is a different focus and will require some voiceover probably, but to patch it up, because I was only able to discuss what was happening right in front of me at that moment, because you have to think all the time.
Absolutely. And it's even for, I know what was going through my mind in the videos that I shot in these brass era cars. And it was also very funny. You talk about the various experiences. And one of the things that was very, very apparent looking at the cars from 1901 through 1909, the pace of technology was astounding.
Yeah.
I mean, in just a few years. And I drove the same day when I was shooting these videos, the 1904 Curved Dash Olds and the 1902 Yale. And now the Oldsmobile cost $762, which was a fortune.
That was a lot in
that time.
Yeah, that's a lot.
The Yale cost $1,700, which was an unbelievable amount of money, but it was six times the car. And I said, you know what? I would have saved up.
Yeah, yeah. The Olds is a wagon. It's basically a wagon with an engine. There's absolutely nothing on it that isn't totally essential to the operation of it. And the Yale is actually more like a, it was out there yesterday, and it's much more like a real car. Yeah. It has real pedals and a steering wheel. And it's amazing how the lack of standardization, you know, we take for granted things like the gas is on the right and the brake is on the left. And like, that is just not the case.
Or that steering wheels exist.
The steering wheels exist.
Like, I was going to ask you, when did that change happen to steering wheels? Because you were in a car with a tiller, and then the car we had a steering wheel, obviously. Was it?
But our steering wheel car was older than the tiller car.
That's correct. So it varied between manufacturers. And also one of the things which is so funny and important for me to remember all the time, because I forget, everyone that was coming to motoring, of course, had never driven a car. So it didn't matter what the controls were. You simply learned how to operate that piece of machinery. The car that I had actually intended to drive on the tour, the 1901 International Charette, again, was older than the Packard, older than the Oldsmobile, but it actually had a vertical steering wheel.
Oh, column. I saw that, yeah.
Sort of like
it looked like some Captain Nemo shit.
Exactly. Right, it's like you're opening a ship door.
It was crazy, yeah.
So it just depended on the manufacturer and what they thought they would do. You actually had, frankly, better handling control with a tiller for a very long time until steering boxes really became sophisticated enough to handle.
I was surprised when we went out in the Oldsmobile with the tiller, because I thought it was going to be very sketchy. And Rupert from Bottoms was like, no, this thing is awesome. It's great. Like, it's really easy to drive. Like, I was like, how is that possible?
Do you think when steering wheels became more common, there were enthusiasts of tillers that were like, no, the tiller's the one with the feedback.
He seemed...
Exactly, yeah. You read in Automotive Age.
Exactly.
Well, you know, these modern conveniences, it's like, you know, paddle shifts. Like, I'll never use those paddle shifts. I mean, who wants those when you can have a good tiller? I think that one of the things that also did away with the tiller, of course, is the fact that it's not convenient to ride with somebody, because the tiller takes up a lot of space as you're
to turn right. He had to get awful close to my bits.
Yep.
Yeah. And of course, if I tilted it up, it's like, you know, here we go. But the tiller also, you found tillers stayed in cars like electrics for much, much longer. Cars that, again, where ease of control. One hesitates to say this today, but basically cars that were aimed at women stayed with tillers longer because they were easier to control than a steering wheel.
Hmm.
They didn't
steering
get
was not light. No. Steering in the Packard was quite heavy.
Yeah.
They didn't understand ratios and stuff.
Another great moment in time where men thought women couldn't handle a simple piece of technology. Exactly.
Yeah. Steering wheel? Oh, my God. What next? They'll vote.
Yeah. She's used to rowboats. They have tillers. This has a tiller. Like, this is such nonsense.
Yeah. When you had the concourse, I was impressed at the number of young people that came out. But the veteran motoring hasn't quite reached that generation yet.
Well, you bring up a very interesting point, and I don't want to reveal anything here yet.
Really? It seems like a good time.
Exactly. Why my show is a wonderful place to reveal a scoop. But one of the things that's quite interesting, we were discussing this in terms of the age of the cars that were going to be eligible for the tour. And something which really impressed me, I know that you're familiar with McPherson College in McPherson, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first visited McPherson, I'd met a lot of alumni from the school and knew that these are very young people who are very passionate about all sorts of cars. When I visited the campus for the first time, I was shocked the number of 18 and 19-year-olds driving Model Ts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there are a bunch of very young people who are extremely, as a matter of fact, we had on our support crew a young fellow named Fernando Escobar.
Oh, yeah. I met Fernando.
Exactly. Who is absolutely nuts for pre-World War I cars.
Yeah. Well, he said he's never met anyone younger than him who can work on the car. They said, well, and you're going to be very, very rich, aren't you? You're going to be the last person alive who knows how to do anything on these cars.
I love Fernando, but he's wrong. There's lots and lots and lots of young people who are absolutely crazy about Brass Era cars. And
weren't there a couple Brass Era cars in the under 30 category of the concourse as
exactly.
well? I remember seeing at least one Model T, right? Or was it an A? Maybe it was an A.
It was an A.
Yeah.
It was an A and a Franklin.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there are a lot of young people who are passionate about this, and we're actually thinking about, here's the big reveal, in next year's Veteran Car Tour, adding a class where we will let Model Ts in, because they were introduced in 1908.
Right.
And have a special class for younger people to bring less expensive
cars.
Well,
you should be able to, like, have a formula where you add their age. You know, you do something with the age of the driver. You know, for every year you are under 40, you get to add a year to your car to get in, right? You could have, like, a formula like that.
Well, you know, it's not about modern or more modern cars. It's about more affordable cars. What many of the cars there, I mean, Oldsmobile, Kurdeft Oldsmobiles are actually not terribly expensive as collector car goes.
Yeah.
But many of the cars there were very, very valuable cars. And so, yeah, people who are 20 years old are not likely to have a Didion Bouton or a Panhard Levasseur.
Yeah, well, that's what, the Red Baron, what was his name again? Bill, the sideburns guy? Crazy Ben?
Oh, Crazy Ben, yes.
Yeah, he was like, man, you got to get Pierce. It's all about Pierce. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, is it? He's like, well, I don't have 375,000, but it's all about the Pierce. I was like, good to know, guys. Note that. It's about the Pierce. Exactly. That's what you want.
Well, actually,
he made it to Bristol in 36 minutes. He was like, that was like how long it took us to get back in a Range Rover.
Well, we made it. Rupert and I made it to Bristol in an hour and 15 minutes.
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
that's pretty good. Although considering like the pace that Oldsmobile could go and how slow it felt like we were going in the Packard, I think we did pretty good. 2.5 hours.
You did.
It's not the worst.
Sort of the handicap. The base timing was an hour and 15 minutes.
Oh, okay.
From figure people leave at 10 and get there starting around 11:15.
We, if our car could rev, we would have done it. And next year, we'll break an hour.
Yeah, we passed the jogger though.
We did.
Proud of that.
Yeah, it took us a long time to pass the
direction. They're running in the correct direction.
It took us a long. The amount of time that we could see the jogger ahead of us, till when we caught him and passed him. Was truly shameful.
I pulled my camera up to film it, and I went, oh, I got time.
And
I put it back down.
And then the question is, did he repass you?
Well, fortunately, it was flat. If there was a hill, he would have. But I found third gear. I got kind of good at driving the car, though. I wasn't bad at driving the car. I was all right. Ian said that he was impressed at my ability to get used to the car. We did a wheelie. Here's how much thing this makes it. How much torque this thing makes it idle. At idle, I had tried to pull out in front of a I don't know why I did, but I dumped the clutch. This is how you dump the clutch, by doing this. I dumped the clutch and we did a proper wheelie at idle. It was awesome.
Wheels off the ground. And for the record, Ian was not complimentary of that particular driving moment.
No, he wasn't.
He was in the back and he
we averaged it out. He averaged it out. Yeah,
but that was quite a thing.
What was the most challenging part about, besides the speed, driving the car in terms of steering, shifting?
I mean, this Packard was one of the first cars, according to you guys, to have an H pattern gearbox. So although it was first was up left, second was down right, and then third was up right. So it was inverted and kind of funky, but it was still like a gear lever that you moved. It wasn't some totally unconventional thing. And then there was two levers. One was the gear lever, and then the other lever would engage you'd kind of pull it back and it would engage the clutch, right, and then it would lock in. And when it locked in, you were in gear, and then you'd push that same lever forward to use the brakes. So that was similar to, like, I've driven a couple of cars that had hand controls, like for paralyzed people. So I was actually kind of used to that motion. So that part of it wasn't all that hard. You know, like your story with the Oldsmobile and the Crown Roads, the alignment wasn't exactly ideal. And so there was like, and it actually had this kind of, steering column, like, you know how in the Mercedes Gullwing, the steering wheel folds down so you could get in? So this had a big, long steering column like this that had a collar in the middle, and you slid the collar up and the whole column would go away like that, which at first glance is probably a nice feature to have. Mm-hmm. But it also created like a ridiculous amount of play. So there's just like nothing. But if you got to the littlest bit, it would like kind of dart around. So even at, you know, 3 miles an hour, I was really having to steer. I couldn't just be like Cody Ho, you know. So when you got up to 20, it was like, we might actually die. There was a moment where I was like, we could really die. Like that, whatever the downhill curve is towards the second beach.
Yes. Mm-hmm. On Purgatory. Mm-hmm.
25 miles an hour down that is as scared as I have ever been in any car I've ever driven.
Which is the other rule of thumb with veteran cars, is the fact that you always use engine braking.
Yes.
So the gear you go up the hill in is the gear you go down the hill in.
Right.
You were going down in high gear.
Yes, I was.
Yes, exactly.
Advice of counsel, I was.
That's true.
Because, you know, they were like, just get it going to good gravity. And I even asked, like, I said to Ian, okay, I'm in gear, I'm engine braking. What happens if it just keeps accelerating? He goes, well, we die. He goes, we just die. That's just how it ends. And
well,
like, oh, good.
Now, of course, Matt is known for his drama, but of course.
No, I was terrified.
I was as well.
Zach was terrified.
He's not known for drama. I was scared.
The reality is, at the bottom of this hill, the route made a right turn. You had, as the operator of this automobile, the option to actually continue going straight forward,
sure,
which did not have involved a turn.
Sure.
That turn at the bottom was not the scary part.
No.
The turn at the top was the scary
part. Yeah, the turn in the middle.
Once we got speed.
Oh, yes, the left turn.
The left turn curving down the hill. That was where I was scared.
So you don't surf, in other words.
I don't surf on 120-year-old tree trunks.
It was like I
might be like slightly dramatizing, but I was really scared in that moment. So you asked what the most challenging part was.
I'm gonna paint the picture because Donald, I think you're being very kind to this car. As we started to hit 19 miles an hour, the floor started shaking up and down under our feet.
Yes.
Both of the front fenders started vibrating at different frequencies.
Yeah.
So one was doing the mambo and one was twerking.
Yeah.
And then all the lights were shaking so much, and like the toe of the front wheels was varying so much. We're like wiggling down the road. I've never felt anything do that. So I like Matt, was suddenly very aware of how quick I might be able to jump out of the vehicle and where I'd want to land.
Yeah. I learned that life is fragile.
It is. And which, by the way, is a good lesson to have even when driving a modern 800 horsepower car on a track.
Yeah, we take it for granted.
Where you need to go and how you need to get there. One of the other things actually about that characteristic of veteran cars is the fact that, remember, we're driving them on road surfaces they were not built for.
Right.
When these cars were new, they were on gravel surfaces, so they're actually designed to travel that way. You would not want a hard steering car that immediately responded, because you get stuck in a groove or a rut,
yeah,
you're gone.
Yeah. Well, we brought the map.
Yes.
So we have this, and I'll. So this is a period.
It's a 1906 map.
This is a map of where you would drive.
Exactly.
So how does this work? How do we read this map, Donald?
We read this map. So these red roads, this is an automobilist's map. So these red roads are improved roads. The ones with the crosshatching are state highways. So they're the finest quality roads you can have. All the rest are dirt, unpaved or gravel. And so here's Newport itself, and here's Bellevue Avenue. So we actually came up right here, right this way, through Middletown, and on East Main Road, and up here, and to where we would have gotten the ferry, across the Mount Hope Bridge to Bristol.
Well, the ferry would have been easier. that would have been luxurious compared to the... So yeah, we drove routes that would have been recommended
exactly
at the time, pretty much, right?
Precisely. So, yeah. You know... Would you have ever turned down a recommended road? I mean, that
never.
Dead man's curve on the hill. It was recommended just for you, sir, Mr. Farah. Yeah. Please take this road.
Now I'll be ready. I also like we were saying earlier, you're intimately aware of every degree of up and down.
Right.
Having never really driven these roads at all before, I didn't know what it looked like. So if you drove this road in a regular car, you know where the hill ends. You know, and I didn't. So I just saw a drop off and a curve, and I went, well, we're going no matter what. I didn't. Now that I know the route a little bit, next year I'll be a little more prepared and calm, I think.
I think that what we need to do to prepare you for next year's Audrain Newport Bristol Newport veteran car tour.
So smooth. Great.
Yeah, there you
absolutely
go.
Is we need to bring out either the Packard or another 1901 car,
yeah,
and have you practice on Mulholland Drive.
Yes. Yeah, I would do that. Ship it. I know where you could ship it to Westside Collector Car Storage. Get those plugs in. yeah. I think that I would drive it around LA for a little bit. I think that would be fun.
I don't think the people of LA would be as nice as the people of Rhode
they
Island
would not.
In
no
traffic.
Way. They're cool when Jay does it, or though maybe you have to be Jay to get that level of street cred. I'll just put on Jay, let me borrow a shirt. Give me one of those denim rigs. I'll be you for a day.
I could reveal another Jay Leno's Garage production secret, but I won't.
The closet of hundreds and hundreds of denim shirts?
No, okay. The wig.
The wig.
In case they have to do some makeup shots.
Oh, yeah.
Dude. That makes sense. We could do that.
He'll give me the wig.
Amazon.
Just
go to Amazon.
I don't think you can find Jay Leno wig on Amazon.
I bet you. I bet we can. I bet Zach could find that right now with no effort whatsoever.
To order three.
Which
of them.
Company do you want to get it from? I found three that worked pretty well.
I should plug the Historical Emporium, which is where I got my outfit, and they have you could be anybody. You could be anybody from any period at this place.
They
didn't pay
job.
Me to say that, but it is great. And the clothes were surprisingly high quality. I'm so glad we didn't do it today. It was 43, 45 degrees, maybe up to 47 or 48 yesterday.
Yes.
And today
a
it's
nice
28.
Yeah,
the high today 20 mile an hour
high
wind.
Today is 30, 32.
And the wind would affect our speed today, too.
Well, actually, you know, the high performance engines always work better in cold conditions.
Yeah.
You know, you get better compression.
I actually, when I got out of the car in Bristol, I couldn't feel my heels. I've never had that sensation before.
How did you freeze
your
toes? Heels?
I don't know, but my heels were frozen. It was the weirdest sensation.
Pushing a car up a hill.
I know everyone else was sweating and I was freezing.
We were like,
funny how that worked.
I was warm. We were like a bobsled team, basically. So
I did feel bad, but somebody has to steer.
That's very true.
Someone had to steer.
It literally will not steer itself.
Yeah. Ben wouldn't do it.
Generally, you get the coxswain to steer the lightest.
Your man will steer for you.
Your man, exactly.
Yes.
Have your man steer there.
But so what are we expecting? What do you think you want to grow, improve, change about the event for next year? It was really well run. I mean, I had a great time. Well,
thank you very much.
But how do we take it to the next level?
Well, first
Model T thing is a good idea.
First and foremost, yeah, bringing more people in. We heard all the participants were really enthusiastic about it. Everyone had a huge smile on their face at the beginning of the day, at lunch, and at the end of the day. Even if their cars didn't make it, they had a great adventure. And that's what people really want to do. And they got to spend time with like-minded souls. And that's terrific. Next year, hopefully, we'll have more people watching along the route. We had a great number of people watching along the route, but I think that will also grow. Bristol, the town that we went to, is known for having the longest continuous 4th of July parade in the country. So they love parades and festivals. So I think that Bristol will really get into this more as we grow the event. And I think that it's a matter of making sure that we can organize it in a way that the performance differential that we see in these early cars is better respected, so that the really fast cars don't feel like they're being held up, and the slower cars, the earlier cars, don't feel like they're being pushed.
Yeah.
So I think that probably a
longer, seem like anyone had trouble passing me. They were so, you good? Yeah. I just went around. It was okay. Exactly. I didn't feel like we were being pushed, except when we were being pushed by humans. That's I was like, pushing, oh, the engine's the running better. Pushing. And they're like, no, that's us. I had such a good time at this event. It was so cool. It was so cool, man.
Well, it was, as I said, it was a great, the realization of a great dream.
Yeah.
I've really fallen in love
section.
With. I know. I really, really fallen in love
with.
But
I thought that was what the cars were meant for.
Yes, but you don't want to get your wonderful period clothes dirty, do you?
Oh, I didn't have a choice. That jacket was covered in oil when I was done.
Ah, I was going to say, so you had that little oil spray can to make you look as if you had done some vintage motoring when you stepped out of your Range Rover?
By oil spray can, do you mean the engine in the back of the Packard?
It could be.
It was not environmentally friendly, that engine.
Well, actually, they were all extremely environmentally friendly because they returned those petrochemicals to the earth from whence they came.
It was great, and seeing those cars on the road is a totally unique experience, and you've never worked so hard to go such a short distance.
Which is fun. I mean, it was really fun. It's a fun experience, and it's fun to see where cars began, the differences between the cars that were there, and then think about where we are now. So it's an exciting thing to do.
And living in history, to me, that's the most exciting part. I mean, the fact that, we talk about the performance of these cars. The thing that really hit me driving that Oldsmobile the first time I drove it and driving it yesterday, most people at that time still walked most places they went. Or they rode a horse or they rode in a carriage. To drive or to ride in one of these cars must have felt like you were on a magic carpet.
Yeah.
Even at 2 miles per hour in the Packard, that's not walking.
I think there's some turbulence in the air on that magic carpet, but I get you.
Yeah. The Oldsmobile was pretty smooth.
Really?
Oldsmobile, that thing, was that Oldsmobile's first car?
Yes.
It was. They didn't have anything on that.
Oh, sorry. That was not Oldsmobile's first car. That was their first mass-produced car.
And
the Curve Dash Olds was the first mass-produced car in the world.
Was it called Curve Dash in the period, or is that just what it's called casually
it's
now?
It's called now.
Okay. Curve what was Dash. It called then? Just the Oldsmobile?
No, I had a model name, which I don't remember.
Actually. Oh, okay. Yeah. Donald doesn't know something, guys.
Someone write
Donald.
This down.
It happens.
We're recording this.
Mark your calendars.
Okay. Is that car that you wanted to drive but didn't? For why didn't you drive that car? It just wasn't running right?
It wasn't running right.
Okay. No. Is that your favorite veteran car? Do you have a favorite veteran car?
Well, my favorite veteran car actually is it's being hidden by that huge limousine. It's a 1909 Isotta Fraschini Tipo FENC, which is an absolutely amazing street version of a race car, which I would have loved to have driven in the event, but it's spectacularly restored for show. And so I think that next year I may be able to spring it loose for the tour. So that's probably my favorite of the cars. My second actually is the Yale. The Yale is an amazing car, really capable. And I love the International Charette because it's very, very rare. Company is only in business for 5 years. That particular car is one of the earliest cars at the Veteran Car Club in the UK that does all the dating of the historic cars. It's one of the first cars they dated. It's done the London to Brighton run since the 1930s.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And so it's an amazing thing. And so I'm really looking forward to getting that up and running reliably for next year.
You know, we had the conversation with some of the folks at the dinner after we were done about how much of an original car it needs to be. Because from what I gather, the Packard that we drove did not have original bodywork. It was like a chassis and an engine or something. And some of the other cars were assembled from bits that had been collected from different cars and turned into one car. And when the cars are 120 years old, you don't always have a choice. But does it matter? Maybe it matters to some very nerdy collectors, but when it comes to doing these types of events, does it matter?
Well, that's an excellent point, Matt. It matters, but in a totally different way than we think of with collector cars from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s. First of all, these are the first cars that were collected, and they were collected by people who wanted to restore them to use on the road. So therefore, making them run was the most important thing. The best of the collectors and the most valuable of these veteran cars are cars which are restored with the correct period parts and in the correct period manner, as opposed to something that was adapted with later engines, brakes, whatever you might want to do, sort of just to keep something running. And in terms of bodywork, of course, they're all made of wood. Yeah. So once they fell out of everyday use and maintenance, and you can imagine what the maintenance was on one of these cars, not just mechanical maintenance, but the cosmetic maintenance on a totally wood-bodied car.
Wood and brass.
Exactly. Yeah. Wood, brass, and the fact that the suspensions, such as they were, you know, they all have these cart springs, but the chassis was also an integral part of the suspension. So the chassis was designed to flex, which, again, would have a very bad effect on the long life of the body. So, yeah, to have a rebodied car with an original chassis, an original engine, an original type engine is really quite acceptable in the veteran car world.
And we were talking to, you know, some of the other folks about it, and they basically said that because the technology moved so fast from 1900 to 1920, the wealthy would get a new car like every single year, mm-hmm. and the old one might get stuck in a barn somewhere or whatever. And so it's interesting how these types of cars became collected and then sort of were not collected for like the next couple of decades, you know, except for the very rare, you know, super, super luxe stuff, right? They really became utilitarian. And so there was this like kind of skip over period of collecting.
Yeah, there was the earliest collectors, and here I'll put in another plug for no apparent reason whatsoever, because God knows when I'll finish this book, but I'm actually working on a book on the history of car collecting. And it's something that when I started the project, I thought, oh, I know exactly when car collecting started after World War II, and it's very simple. But there were a lot of car collectors before World War II in the UK and in the US. And as I said, they collected in a slightly different way and for a slightly different reason. And when collecting really sort of took off after World War II, people started looking for things that were more akin to the driving style that they were used to. So they started to look for very fast cars and very luxurious cars of the 1930s and 20s, rather than going back to the pre-World War I cars, because a lot of people had direct experience with them, really weren't in the collecting mode, yeah. because they were just buying new things.
And the very luxurious stuff from the end of the 20s and the 30s would have been limited because of the Depression.
Exactly.
So they just, like, you know, there's like 12 Duesenbergs or whatever. But
Depression, scrap drives, yeah. all of that really yeah. sort of bit into that. But the other interesting thing is the fact that, again, the people that collected these pre-World War I cars restored them in a way that also ran against the sort of restoring ethos that began to grow up in the 1950s and 60s, where everyone wanted something that was exactly as new and shinier than shiny and all of that. And that was not what these early collectors did. Because, again, it's really evidenced by what we saw yesterday with the kind of people that own these cars and get out and use them. They're not afraid of getting the cars wet. We had one person call and say, well, gee, what happens if it rains? Will the event go on? I said, yeah. I said, well, my car is made of wood. I said, they're all made of wood, and sort of boats are made of wood, and they're in the water. And so he's like,
yeah. No, I did notice that even though the cars yesterday, many of which, like you said, are very valuable, they didn't seem to be precious.
Right.
You know, people would lean on them, You know, put their foot up on them, you know, like strangers. Yeah. Like, and you wouldn't get mad. Like, imagine being at Pebble Beach and someone just like leans on this car. People would lose their mind. You know, you would be like shunned from the community. But like these
kids
cars, like,
and inviting kids to come and sit in the car. And,
yeah,
you know?
They're just nothing about them was precious, even if they were very rare and valuable. And I thought that was just such an interesting thing that you just never see.
It's another cool thing, again, about the veteran car community. I think they're terrific people.
Yeah, I know. There's some characters.
Yeah.
There's definitely some characters out there. Some, and are those your let's call them your regulars that you know? Do they collect other periods, or are those guys diehard veteran collectors?
Some do. Many have a wide variety of cars. As a matter of fact, and this is where I will step into my full judgmental mode, because I like people like yourself whose tastes are far-ranging. Not the people who say, oh, I only like X and I'll never look at Y and, oh, you know, they never made cars, that kind of thing. Veteran car people are absolutely dyed-in-the-wool veteran car people, but they also will drive Porsches and Ferraris and other things, whereas a lot of people who drive newer cars would never think about a veteran car. So I think that it's a more interesting group to spend time with because they've got more interesting interests.
Well, I think, you know, as we're starting to see, and I'm reading more articles about people who buy cars specifically to do certain events like Goodwood or like the Copper State or whatever, London to Brighton is one of those. And then this is in that same vein as well. So it might drive people who might not otherwise buy them to buy one just thinking, hey, that looks like a fun thing to do.
Which brings up another point you asked quite a while ago about the dating of the cars for this event. And one of the reasons that we specifically made it 1907 and then extended 1909 is to get more people involved. London to Brighton is a spectacular event, but it's limited to 1904 and older for a good reason, because it celebrates the repeal of the Flag Act in 1904. So if you don't know what the Flag Act was.
I don't. What's the Flag Act?
Ah,
you guys know what the Flag Act is?
Well, ah, okay.
One nerd. One nerd. Congratulations.
Exactly.
One nerd and one senior citizen.
Okay, very good.
Know who the Flag Act is?
Hey, Matt, I think Donald knows also.
Two nerds. Two nerds and one senior citizen.
Well, actually, I think I might qualify on both accounts, nerd and senior citizen.
What's the Flag Act?
But the Flag Act was the repeal of an act that was the Road Locomotive Act in the UK. Because motor cars were so incredibly dangerous to the populace, you had to have a man waving a red flag in front of your car so that people weren't scared. And that basically limited cars to 4 miles per hour.
I didn't know what that was called, but I do remember hearing, you had to have a barker in front of your car. Get out the way!
Motor car coming!
Get out of the way!
Which actually also helped because the people had to push their car up the hill your flagman could be one of the people to push your car up the hill. But
downhill, they got to learn to run a little faster.
Downhill is sprinted out.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you're really in trouble downhill because he's got to sprint in front of the car. But, so
that makes sense.
This celebrates the repeal of the Flag Act. And so here, there are a lot of people who have 1905 and 1906 versions of those same cars. And frankly, because London to Brighton is so popular, the price differential, the value differential between a 1904X and a 1905X is tremendous.
Yeah.
So it opens up to more people to actually enjoy the cars that are more affordable.
I know that a lot of people who do the London to Brighton one keep cars in London for that. Do you expect to have a warehouse here in Newport where people can leave their veteran cars for the rest of the year?
Well, we actually happen to have a wonderful car storage facility in the Audrain family, Audrain Park Place, located in lovely Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Nice. And we'd be very happy to keep your veteran car.
You guys like
car.
That tea?
Exactly.
Teed that right up. For a car storage business.
I think that's one of the things that as people, as you said, collecting has certainly moved to a much more experiential level. That's what people want cars that they're going to use. They don't want cars to look at.
Yeah.
And, again, the veteran car thing is sort of the absolute polar opposite of the 0 kilometer car in Aspic, you know,
our
branded.
Car didn't even have an odometer.
Exactly.
How many miles are on it? I don't know.
Oh, probably
tell you.
Three. Yeah, three. Yeah. That's it. Yeah, three.
Count the rings on the tree that was killed to make the car.
cut the bonnet.
I think, did the olds have an odometer on it?
It did not.
It did some. I saw a couple of cars.
There's
that
a couple
did.
Cars that did. Yeah,
yeah. This odometers. One, this Renault does.
Yes.
This one.
Odometers started to come around in 1906
too.
Yes, there are.
That odometer, it's got like 170,000 kilometers or something on it. It's got a bunch.
It's been driven.
Yeah, that's good.
And at vast rate of speed.
Yeah. And I did see a few aftermarket gauges. I saw a couple of folks had little flip up, like hidden compartments. In the dash where they'd flip it up and there's a couple like auto meter gauges back there.
What were they monitoring?
temperature of the coal and the steam, yeah, you know, stuff like that.
Imagine calling auto meter, like, do you have a furnace temp gauge?
Exactly.
Do you have one that says boiler
Try
on
Home
it?
Depot for that.
Yeah. I was going to say a telegraph to ring down to the engine room. More steam.
Yeah.
It's an iceberg ahead.
That steam car, that thing was so cool.
That's absolutely amazing.
I mean, it was amazing, and it was like so quiet too. Like when it wasn't whistling, it was really loud. But then it's just kind of it just chug off like it, yeah. It was amazing.
We were talking about before the event. We were talking about technology and how it comes and goes around in circles. And we were talking about the Lear steam car that was supposed to have run at Indy in 1968. It never made it, but there you are. So I mean. Steam may yet come back. I mean, let's talk about the electrification. Talking about Jay's collection of steam cars, he's got a number of Dobles. And his latest Doble, I think it's a 1923 or 24, that was Howard Hughes' car.
Oh, really?
It can actually go from rest to motion in, I think, 45 seconds.
Oh.
It's got preheaters. Oh. So, yeah. So.
Oh, neat. Like from being off to driving.
From being off to driving away.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat.
So, I mean, that's scary, but yes, it's neat.
Do you think, could a Baker Electric do the veteran run? Could it make it?
In fact, we have in the collection a Rausch & Lang electric roaster from 1913 that was originally delivered to Briggs Cunningham's mother. Oh. And we thought about running that in the tour as well, but we're concerned about the range.
Is it, can it not do 20? Or 40 miles to there and back.
It would do the 20 certainly, but how long would it take to recharge the batteries to make it back to make sure you didn't
there's
stop?
There's no Electrify America in Bristol.
There's no Rausch & Lang superchargers.
Is that in how do you Bristol. Charge it?
It's got.
It must have an inverter 16, at this point, right?
Probably it's got 16 12-volt batteries. Oh, okay. In it, so, yeah.
So you could. So. Just a alligator clip charger.
Alligator clip. Get a bunch of start boxes and, right. and line them up.
I would, if the opportunity presents itself, I would love to do it in an early electric car. I think that would be very cool.
Tiller steering.
I know.
Yeah.
As a sailor, I love tiller steering. I think it's awesome.
And it's side saddle tiller steering. So
yeah.
It's on the side of the car. So you're right here. And it's also got a jump seat that faces backwards into the car. So it's like.
That is the other thing about. These veteran cars is we talk about lack of standardization. There are seats sometimes
everywhere.
Facing all four directions.
Yeah,
like
guard towers or something.
Yeah, like exactly. Who came up with these seating arrangements? It's so crazy.
The St. Louis has that wonderful fold-out front seats. Exactly.
There was this one that was a rumble seat in the back. Imagine that was in the front. It was a frumble.
It was a frunk.
It was a frumble seat.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you ever been quail hunting, they have sometimes the quail rigs, and you can ride on the bow, and it was like, sort of like that. But you are the crash structure.
Exactly.
In the frumble seat.
In case of an accident, you arrive first on the scene.
You were ejected the furthest. This is such a cool event. I mean, and maybe, can there be a veteran tour paired with the Concours? There could be a little one, maybe.
There
fall,
could be
the fall one.
There could be, although we have had veterans, of course, entered in the Concours that have done the Concours tour.
Oh yeah, right. There is a Concours tour. Yeah, yeah.
If you want to drive 50 or 60 miles without a lunch break.
Well, how long is London to Brighton? 72, right?
It's 72 miles.
72 miles. That's a long way.
And many cars don't finish.
Yeah. Dude's like, are there hundreds of cars that enter that?
400 cars the last
Whoa.
Mile.
That's yeah. so many.
So, I mean, we all fully expect that next year we'll certainly have at least 60 or 70 cars.
That'd be so cool. Count me in 100%. 100%.
Excellent.
We have some questions from Donald off of our Patreon, and we can do the back third of this here show. And we've reviewed them. They're good. We got some good ones. For those at home, not for those of you here too, patreon.com/thesmoking tire podcast. Give us your money. We will buy a we will pay our motor man to wave a red flag in front of our car.
push it up the hill.
Ironically, we had a Range Rover behind our car with the hazards on as like blocking from the rear. So that's kind of the same thing.
Same thing, exactly.
If we didn't have that, it would have been much sketchier. That prevented us from being rear-ended at a very high rate of speed, I think.
Well, that's another great veteran car accessory, or sort of little neon LEDs.
Oh, the
Yale had
the them. Yale has yes, those. Exactly. Yeah, had yes. flashing lights on yeah. it. Nick pulled out like a clicker, it looked like a Viper alarm clicker, and I was like, "What are you doing with that?" And he's like, "Turning on my hazards."
The lights, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, Zach, what do we got?
All right, first question is from Joe. He says to everyone at the table, "What is the most beautiful car of all time to you?" His pick is the Rolls Royce Roundoor.
Oh, good choice.
That's a very interesting choice. Most beautiful car of all time anywhere. I'm going to go extremely esoteric on this one and make everyone run to their Google machines. The Alfa Romeo Canguro.
Never heard of it. Beautiful car of all time. It's got to be something French. It's got to be something Art Deco, you know, one of the Delahaye or that. Were you Amelia and that absolutely. One that just sold for like $12 million?
The Figone Filaschi Teardrop.
Extraordinary, yeah, absolutely extraordinary.
The details.
It was like
a
prettier
amazing.
Bugatti Atlantic.
And what was wonderful about that car too is the fact that I went to preview the car a couple of weeks before the auction and heard it run because it's a race car.
Was that race car?
Yeah, Tommy Lee drove that. To records on the dry lakes.
And he's great at drones. Like, how about that?
Different Tommy Lee. So
that was a terrible joke.
Did
I'm
you
sorry.
Find it?
I did.
Is it awesome?
On the screen, it's very pretty. I mean, it's Alfa Romeo. It's like, this is what they do.
Oh, yeah. It's an Alfa Romeo beautiful. Race car from the 60s, right? It's like the really hatchback nice. One kind of thing, right? That might be kind of insulting.
Kind of a fastback.
Well, it's a one-off. You're thinking about the Montreal, which it sort of vaguely resembles some of the design cues. This is an amazing car built on the chassis of the 33 Sports Racer.
Yeah, it looks like that.
Which
yeah.
is a crazy
yeah.
fast car.
Is that it up on the wall back there? The camback and that poster in the corner? I don't want to insult that by calling.
Oh
it
no, that's a TZ. That's a TZ one.
Oh okay.
Yeah.
Similar vibe,
but this is a big V8, 4-cam V8 race car.
Oh okay.
It's very cool. Astonishing.
Very cool.
All right. Chris Navio asks, Donald, what is your take on the Duesenberg Car Company being revived today, like Bugatti was back in the 2000s? He would like to see that.
We should extend that to not just Duesenberg, but the Hispano Suiza, which. Yeah, that face. If you guys haven't seen the revived Hispano Suiza, this is an ugly car. I mean, this is ugly, and it's really not even in kind of a like charmingly cute ugly way. Like it is just bad.
I have a really, really, really strong feeling about revivals of marks. In general, I think it's a really bad idea. Let sleeping dogs lie and the dead be buried. If you're going to bring back a mark, then the new car has to have something that made the old car what it was. And it's like I'm not going to go there. But if a company was known for its engines, don't build a design, put a badge on it, and buy somebody else's engine. It has to be about the engine.
Okay.
If it was all about the chassis and handling, then get the best chassis engineer you can possibly have and make the best handling car on the road and then put a beautiful body on it. Simply just to stick a badge on it. It's just wrong and
so how do you think Bugatti's done?
I think that actually Bugatti has done a fairly good job because they build expensive, high-performance cars, and that's what Ettore Bugatti built in his lifetime. They have no relation to those cars, but they are still in the spirit of. And I think largely the Volkswagen Group has actually been a really good brand steward of all the brands that they've assembled. It's amazing that they have all these brands and they can actually separate a Skoda from a Volkswagen. It's astounding.
Yeah.
I think they were aided, frankly, by Romano Artioli's EB110. Because if it had not been for that, the gulf between the last Bugattis and what Volkswagen Group is doing now would have been too far to bridge.
Those cars are a little awkward looking, but they're actually very well-made cars.
That, EB110s?
Yeah.
Oh, they're fantastic.
And everyone who's ever driven one, and I haven't, but I was with Bruce Canepa last week, who has two of them, and he was going on, and this is a racing driver, yeah. you know, who's really driven everything. And he was going on and on and on about how well made and fast and stable and nice to drive that car actually is.
Absolutely. Do you know Simon Kidston?
Yeah. Well, he's got that cool purple Lambo.
Simon almost killed me in his EB110. I was driving from my apartment in Bergamo, Italy to Monaco in my Fiat Panda. And speaking of veteran motoring, I never realized until I drove from Bergamo to Monaco in the Panda that the Autostrada from Genoa all the way to the French border is uphill the entire way. Never knew that. But I'm driving along on the highway, and I see this little pickup truck in front of me, which is going slower than I was in the Panda. I said, okay, we can't have this. So I do what you do in Europe. You look in your mirrors, you signal, you pull out, throw the thing as far as to the firewall as it can, and get past the truck. And I'm looking at this dot in my mirror. It's coming faster, faster, faster. Ooh. I just get back into my lane just in time for this thing to go, and it's an EB110. I'm thinking, So I get to Monaco, and I'm driving through town, and I see an EB110 parked in front of the casino. And I go to an auction preview later that afternoon, and I say, Simon, did you drive down from Geneva? He said, yeah, I did. I said, by any chance, did you drive the EB110? He said, yes, I did. I said, you almost ran me off the road. So, oh, was that you and that white panda?
Would the owner of the black Bugatti EB110 yes. Please come to the casino registrar's office? We'd like to have a word with you.
Precisely. So, I mean, the point is, again, here, just like the vintage cars, also with those cars, most of the people who own them also drive them, which is also a terrific thing.
Yeah. What is Duesenberg doing? The question was about Duesenberg. Is there a new Duesenberg? That
I hope not.
No, I think he was asking, is that something we'd like to see?
Oh, yeah. No, we don't need Duesenberg. It's not a sexy name, even if the cars are great. It's like,
yeah.
there's only a few people that would really, really understand.
Although,
that.
You know, for a modern Duesenberg, I think that sort of an opportunity that was, of course, incredibly missed by General Motors was the Cadillac 16 in 2005. Oh, yeah. That was a fabulous car.
Cadillac, and we talked about this briefly before the show, concept cars and then their dreadful production versions. Pontiac in the 90s had amazing concept cars and then terrible production cars. Cadillac drops bombs. They drop amazing, the 16, the Cyan, Cyan, or all these amazing concepts.
But the Evoque did actually become the XLR.
Yep, that one did.
So, yeah.
But they really had, that 16 concept 16, was incredible, and they should have done that one.
Yeah,
that and they could have done amazing. It.
They could have.
They could have done it.
It was production ready.
Yeah.
Alas.
Yeah.
All right. Sean Gallagher says, for everyone, if you could combine any car interior, exterior, and powertrain, which would you combine to make the best two-door GT car?
Ooh,
it's tough.
Very hard.
A tough one.
We get a lot of these like Legos questions, but
yeah, yeah.
They're fun, but it's hard.
I would say an Aventador SVJ engine with a Porsche PDK gearbox, an Audi R8 interior, and
all wrapped up in an Avant
and a Talbot Lago body.
Ooh,
or like, something
nice. It's very funny because I talked about this big reveal that, and I've given you like this is the third scoop for the smoking tire.
Yes. We corner them and then we scoop them.
Osborne, isn't it true that?
Yeah.
I have to say, and I'm not doing this because of any product consideration on their part, but I have done something incredibly uncharacteristic for me, and I've ordered a new high performance car.
Because I'm an old car guy.
It's the new GR Corolla. You guys don't know.
Everybody knows.
Yeah. Announced that today. Oh my GR God. Corolla.
Everybody knows.
Oh, no, you bought a Porsche, right?
I did not buy a Porsche. I did not buy a Porsche. In fact, I bought a car which I think has an incredibly beautiful interior, has an amazing engine, a great chassis because I've driven it a couple of times now. I really, really love it. A Ferrari Roma.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's. I can see you. Yeah. I can see you in a Ferrari Roma. What color?
Grigio Ingrid.
Oh, that's a good color.
With a red and chocolate brown interior.
Oh, that'll be lovely.
Yeah.
That'll be really good. They drive great.
Oh, yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
They're really
amazing.
Good driving
absolutely
cars. Amazing. And they look cool, too.
Yeah.
Especially in the right color. Some colors can be a little
red is not the color for that car.
No,
oh,
no, no.
My God.
The blues, silvers and grays are really nice. Black is good. Red is because it's rare a Ferrari's not good in red, but that one isn't.
Yeah, that's not good at all. And I also got, because I'm such a retro guy, the chrome grill.
Oh, yeah. You keep it's like a 60s GT thing.
Exactly.
Kind of throwback. That's good. Congratulations.
Me, 60s GT guy.
I like that. That's your first. Is that your first Ferrari?
My first new Ferrari, yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
What was your older one?
I have right now, it's for sale, so anyone would like to buy it. An 81 400i.
Oh, they're cool.
It's a very cool car. I've also had a 308 GT4, which is a spectacular car.
Those are
car.
Cool too, yeah.
Absolutely amazing, amazing, amazing car.
Is yours like, is it over at the other building?
No.
Okay, because I saw a 400i
yes,
over there.
No, that like, one's a 5-speed. Mine's an automatic. And my 5-speed, my 400i automatic is a really neat car because it was actually delivered to the U.S. new in period and federalized. So it's got an 85-mile-per-hour speedometer in it.
That's hilarious.
Just so cool. The pegless speedometer in
the
car.
That was one of the... We've had a lot of dumb rules in this country. That 85-mile-an-hour speedometer thing was among the dumbest. It was really stupid.
After all, you're not going to drive any faster than 85 if your speedometer says you can't.
But every one of those cars, the needle would just like keep going around, you know?
And the Ferrari is wonderful because, of course, they use the standard Ferrari speedometer. It just stops at 85 and then it has a long yellow line that goes the rest of the way.
It just doesn't have numbers after
doesn't
that.
Doesn't have numbers after that,
that's
exactly.
That's hilarious. Yeah, buy Donald's Ferrari.
Exactly.
It's probably well taken care of.
Very well taken care of. Wonderful pedigree.
Comes with a free bow tie.
Comes with comes with a complimentary Matt Farah. What do you have? Hats?
He's got some hats.
I got hats.
Okay, because of the Matt Farah
hat.
Hat
in.
Exactly.
You buy Donald's Ferrari and you provide evidence of a bill of sale with says Donald Osborne Ferrari 409. I will throw in a hat.
A Matt Farah smoking tire hat, and I'll throw in a bow tie.
Wrap there it up.
Go. There we go. All right, Daniel.
Another
Berman.
Car sold on the smoking tire.
If you'd really do sell that from this show, that would be awesome.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Donald, I'm an automotive design student, and our professors spend a lot of time discussing the future of our industry. Most of the focus is put on the past decade, like Tesla and AV tech. But is there a particular time in automotive history that you think car design or car theory could learn from or draw from for today?
Well, first and foremost, it's a great question because design, of course, is very, very close to my heart. I think that one of the most important things that has been lost in contemporary car design is color. You know, all cars do not have to be gray, black, white, or gray.
How many new cars will have like 6 different grays to choose from?
It's astonishing.
Crazy. Yeah, it's wild.
And you can have any of those grays with the black interior. You also don't have to get to the point, again, I'm not criticizing Porsche necessarily, but Porsche and the Ferrari tailor-made programs that allow you to do lots of interesting things, but at a ridiculous cost,
yeah,
which is insane.
Audi has a pretty reasonable paint-to-sample program. It's like, pretty reasonable. It's not nothing, but it's like, for like under $5,000, they will paint a car any color you want. You give them a chip. And most people don't really know about it, or they want to buy a car off the lot, and so
right.
You know they're not stocking lime green or whatever. But you can get an Audi painted any color you want, and you can get BMWs painted any color you want too. And it's not terribly expensive for what you are getting.
Yeah. So I mean, there's certainly that. That's the one thing that immediately hits me. The other is that Maserati did something rather interesting, which was a failure, unfortunately, back in the days when they introduced the Gran Coupé. The thought was, you know, why are we building cars today with leather and wood in the interior, which is, you know, going back to the veteran age? And they started to use contemporary fabrics, some high-performance sport fabrics, some great synthetic pattern fabrics, things like that, and materials. And I think that if the manufacturers could do a more interesting job of using more contemporary materials in cars, because it seems very odd to look at some very, very modern cars that suddenly have a swatch of wood across the dashboard, which makes no sense.
Some companies are doing some neat stuff. Like, I mean, I kind of rolled my eyes at it, but like Rivian is doing this sort of like reclaimed wood, which, you know, okay. I guess technically all wood is reclaimed.
Exactly. But IKEA interior thing.
Yeah, and like vegan leather, which is really
in
just
Tesla.
Nice plastic. But I think, you know, in Europe, they don't do it as much here, but in Europe, there's a lot of very luxurious cloths that
which
I love.
Also, for a high performance car, cloth is the most sensible interior because
it's so good.
Grips you.
Yeah. I agree. I think cloth would be a good one. But to touch on the design stuff, I just finished reading Unsafe at Any Speed by Ralph Nader for the first time, which I really encourage everyone to read. It's pretty wild. You know, it's 50 years old, but some of it is incredibly relevant today. And
my first car, by the way, of course, was a 1963 Corvair.
Was it?
A convertible, yes.
I didn't quite understand... you know, it was always, the Unsafe at Any Speed, the Corvair. But when you read 50 pages on the Corvair being a complete hunk of shit and how dangerous it was and the asterisks that GM put on that car and producing it anyway and how obvious the fixes were and how cheap, you know, how cheap they were about the whole thing, you go, oh, my God, they, you know, the Ralph was really right about this thing.
Yeah, but the VW Beetle was twice as dangerous as the Corvair.
Sure, but and it wasn't made in America.
A 356 was four times as dangerous because you could actually go faster in it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they had a lot of the same the same issues.
A Gullwing, for that matter, actually.
Yeah, but a lot of the car design, you know, today is driven by these standards, whether it's crashworthiness or pedestrian impact or you know, how bright the lights can be and what height they have to be from the road. And so a lot of the stuff that we say, oh, you know, they don't make them beautiful like they used to. It's like, well, yeah, but if you hit a person at 5 miles an hour, everyone involved was dead. So maybe technically that's for the best, even if it means that we aren't all driving XK120s and Isotta Franchinis.
Well, come on. Wouldn't you want to be decapitated by that cobra as you were hit at, you know?
That would go right into your chest.
Exactly,
I just finished the chapter about the 59 Eldorado Fins. In the early 60s, a lot of people died by Eldorado Fin. Like, you look at a 59 Eldorado now and you go, look at that. How come we can't make it like that? It's like, well, a 14-year-old girl had a fin go right through her lungs.
Darwinism. Yeah. Sort of thing.
Is there a lot more driving in reverse happening back then?
No, you know what it was? It was literally like she was running and catching a Frisbee and it was parked on the side of the road. And she like ran in and was straight impaled on it, like on her feet.
That is operator error. Crashed. That is operator error. Exactly. Yeah.
No, read that book if you get a chance. It's wild.
Mayhem with an Eldorado.
Right? Eldorado just murdering people while parked.
More like El Diablo.
Yeah.
Get these Cadillacs off the streets.
Yeah. Anything Amazing. Else on that list there, Zach?
Donald, what pre-1970s cars are underappreciated today?
Oh, gosh. Tons of them. I think that pre-1970s is not pre-1970. Get the year right.
If it's on the line, it's okay. We're not.
It's on the line. Excellent. AMC AMX 390.
Oh.
Fabulous car. Absolutely amazing car. You know, everybody talks about all the great Mopar muscle cars and the GMs and Fords. This car handles. I mean, it feels actually more like a Shelby GT350. Than anything. Is also very well built, and they go for dirt compared to some of these other cars.
Yeah, when the brand doesn't continue to the present day, you know, when you can't connect it to the to the present day, the value certainly is depreciated.
But it's a fantastic car, and, you know, well, I know, I don't want to go there.
All right. Joe Leonard asked, in what car did you experience your most memorable, quote, don't meet your heroes moment? So which car was the most disappointing?
Yeah. one of the great benefits to the living that I'm fortunate to make is the fact that I get to drive a lot of cars. And there are some cars that I always wanted to have. And then I get to drive them. And it's like, oh, okay, I've experienced that enough. For years and years, this is going to sound really bizarre. But for years and years and years, I loved MGB GTs. Because I always liked MGs. Good looking
little car.
Great looking car. Another little known design fact, but the MGB GT was designed by Pininfarina. They did the hardtop for it. And so I thought, oh, this is so cool. It's like a miniature Aston Martin kind of thing. Get an early car with a wonderful piped leather interior and this whole deal and chrome wires. And I drove and I thought, oh my God, this car is awful. Absolutely awful. Dynamically, it's terrible. It doesn't have the benefit of the open air roadster experience. And so there's like no reason whatsoever to have this car at all. So after a day and a half of driving one, I thought, okay, I can put this down.
Yeah.
Don't need to go there.
I've had a couple of those, Buick Grand National. Yeah. Keep that. Mercedes SLR McLaren. Ugh, keep that.
You don't
Jay
like the
Jay
like,
loves the
McLaren. You don't like the the thing I like about the SLR McLaren is the vibration of the exhaust pipes under your feet. That's the coolest thing about
the
it.
The engine is the best part about it, but it's like $400,000. It's got a 5-speed automatic. Like no, no thanks. Yeah, I've actually been fortunate enough that most of my quote heroes have lived up to it. At least in the right, you know, circumstance. You know, if I can understand why someone who has driven a Countach that has been sitting for 6 months and they take it once around the block from cold and they go, well, this thing sucks. I get that because it takes 45 minutes to warm the oil up. But once it's warm, it's the greatest thing in the world. And so, you know, I've fortunately made it through the wall. But yeah.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing, too, is also, what are the expectations that we are bringing to the cars?
Right.
You know, if we expect something like early Ferraris, is a very interesting thing. Driving some Ferrari 212s with beautiful coach-built bodies, and they look so incredibly elegant and chic and refined, and they're not.
Tractors.
They're really noisy and brutal to handle. They're fun. They're just not what they appear to be.
Yeah,
that's
all.
So you put your head in the right space, and then they're great cars.
All right. Thomas Hawes asks, what's the one that got away for you?
Oh, there's actually two cars that are still on my list. From the time, actually, I was a little boy and first discovered cars, I went to my first New York auto show at the Coliseum and in 1964, and I fell madly in love with the Maserati Quattroporte, the first Maserati Quattroporte. Yeah. And I've kept looking for one and come so close to buying one and never had one yet.
Our friend's got one. Our friend Doug has one.
That's right.
Exactly. It's amazing, too.
They're fabulous. I mean, it was, I remember the car and driver road test of it, and it said a Learjet for the road. That, oh, this is so cool. And the other is a Citroën SM, which I will also have one day.
Yeah, they're cool. But now that Jerry Hathaway died, no one can work on them.
It's tough.
There's a guy named Jerry Hathaway who passed away four or five years ago.
Yeah. SM World.
And he was like, there were two types of SMs, ones that Jerry had worked on and ones that Jerry had not worked on. And the difference in the two was obvious from the second you got in the car. Yeah. And as soon as this guy died, like, everybody sold their SMs. Jay got rid of one. My friend Alex Roy got rid of one. And like, you just, they're like, nobody else who has ever lived could work on them now.
There's, I'll tell you a very quick, funny SM story. We were chatting before the show about this Mitsubishi Montero that I owned. And
Ronald said it was the worst car he's ever had.
I had it for 3 weeks. It was absolutely horrifying. And I traded it. I bought it in 1986, and I traded it in 1986 for the then brand new 1987 Alfa Romeo Milano. And I was living in Manhattan at the time, and I bought it from a dealer in Manhattan whose name I won't mention because some people may know it. It was the worst dealer on the planet. There's some really nice people working there. So I brought the Milano in for service one day, and I'm waiting for it to pick it up. And I'm chatting with some of the salespeople in the showroom. And there's one woman who was a salesperson there. I'd gotten to know pretty well. And we're chatting. We're talking about sort of cars we love and why. And I mentioned the Citroën SM. She said, oh, my husband and I have one of those. I said, really? I said, would you think of selling it? I said, well, I don't know, maybe. I said, well, actually, again, I always knew values. Would you take my Milano as an even trade for it, because the values are about the same. It's a 10-year-old SM and Milano. It was about 11 months old. And so I said, well, let me ask my husband about it. So she called me up and said, yeah, I think he's interested. You know, why don't you come down? They lived outside of Princeton, New Jersey. So I drove the Milano down so he could see the Milano, and I took the SM out for a drive, and it was absolutely great. He said, God, you're so good at driving this. It was white with a brown leather interior, 5-speed. And he said, I've never seen someone drive one of these cars for the first time that was as good on the brakes as you are. I said, that's great. It's obviously your car.
The nipple brake thing is really strange in those cars. It takes some getting used to.
And so I thought, okay, fine. We've got a deal. This is fantastic. Now I'm living in Manhattan. And in Manhattan, you park your car in a commercial parking garage. So I get back to Manhattan, and I say to the guy that runs the garage, I said, oh, you know, I'm going to get a new car. I said, oh, what are you going to get? Oh, Citroën SM. I said, oh, no, we don't take those here. We don't take those exotic cars here. I said, oh, okay. Then I called my insurance company. I said, well, you've just paid the premium on the Alfa Romeo, so for the length of that period of time, we will cover your Citroen. After that, we don't insure those either. So I thought, okay, here's a car I could buy and I couldn't insure or park. So I guess it wasn't going to happen. But it was heaven above watching out for me, because the idea of using a 10-year-old SM as an everyday car in Manhattan would have been just absolute
Yeah, that would have been a struggle.
Hell, yeah.
When I lived in Manhattan for 2 years, my daily driver and my only car was a Hummer H1. I was stupid. I was so dumb. I don't know what I was thinking. And I lived, when I brought it to the parking garage where I had the previous car, the guy was like, oh no. He was like, and I was like, but you have, please, you know, how.
Did you end up parking at the piers?
In 2005, it was $1,300 a month to park it in New York City. And it was so terrible in every way. It was such a piece of shit. It was miserable it was like driving a school bus. And when I bought it, I was working in New Jersey. So I would commute up the FDR Drive, across the Harlem River Drive, over the George River in New Jersey. And at the time, the price of diesel was like half in New York of what it was. So it was really, I'd fill it up at work, and that was cheap. And then I stopped working at that job. And now I never left New York State anymore to go to New Jersey. And all of a sudden, my fuel bill doubled, and I had it about 3 months. I couldn't get rid of it fast enough. I traded it straight up for a Mini. Which the salesman had a picture of us like shaking hands with the two cars. He was so proud to take in this giant piece of junk on trade for a tiny little Mini. And that was a very smart move, because I loved that Mini. But speaking of horrible daily drivers, you don't want a horrible daily driver in New York City.
No, you do not.
Someone left dog shit on the hood. They don't like when you're driving a Hummer in New York City in 2005. They don't like you.
Oh.
You are enemy of the state.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it was bad. I don't encourage anyone to buy those. They're really junk.
Two more. Myron Vernis, our friend.
Indeed.
Asked, will Mine important as well. Japanese cars ever have a regular place at high-end Concours events in the United States? And if so, when?
Well, Myron, any of your cars have a place here at the Audrain, because I love all of your cars. Myron and I are sort of separated at birth when it comes to the love of really bizarre cars.
He's got the weirdest stuff.
Again, speaking of steam, he's got that wonderful, I just forgot the name of it. It's a wonderful 1950s steam car. It was actually
a steam car in the 50s?
Yes.
Oh my God.
It was absolutely fantastic.
Are there any Japanese veteran cars? What's the oldest Japanese car?
The oldest Japanese car is a Toyota. The original or licensed?
Oh, I don't know.
Toyota built some BMW Dixies under license.
Oh.
And also some Austin 7s, which are basically the Dixie as well. And then Toyota's first original car was 1938.
Oh, okay. So, and that was the first Japanese car?
First original design. Okay. Yeah. And interestingly, that's a wonderful story, too. It's not a wonderful story. I think it's a wonderful story. You may decide it's boring as heck. But the earliest Toyota extant is actually in the Laumann Museum in The Hague. Evert Laumann...
Was it sentenced there for being...
Yeah.
Evert Laumann, who owns the museum, his father, as he is now, was the Toyota distributor for the Low Countries and Northern Germany. So it was actually a car that his father had sold new. Toyota doesn't have one. They've been trying to buy it back from him, and he won't sell it.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, it's a very, very cool thing. I think there are lots of really interesting Japanese cars that should be welcome absolutely everywhere. Again, as people discover the fact that there are cars that have really interesting design stories, interesting engineering stories, and the fact that, I mean, you think about the Honda S600s. I mean, just absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
S800s,
awesome.
Rather. S800s are amazing cars. I mean, those four tiny carburetors and chain
Revved
drive.
10,000.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're cool.
Just absolutely astonishing things.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Yes, Myron.
Yes,
there will
yes
be Japanese
Myron. You're
cars.
Welcome. Exactly.
Yeah, and he owns all of them.
The last one is just someone's doing a road trip from New Jersey to the Audrain. What road would you recommend? Like, what's a fun road on the way?
Oh,
don't you just drive on 95 the whole way?
I mean, they're probably trying to avoid
that.
I mean,
honestly, there's not a lot of options.
If you want to
come by Lime Rock, right? Can you come through past
Lime
Rock?
I would take the Garden State up to the Tappan Zee and then across and down through Connecticut, and that way, yeah, that's the best way to go.
Just avoid 95.
Yeah,
because it's not fun. Well, Donald, I can't thank you enough for having Zach and I here this week. We had such a good time yesterday. You can count us in every year. As long as we have a car from the Audrain collection to drive. And, of course, we'll be back in October for the Concord. Is it September or October?
September 29th, sorry. October 2nd.
Yeah, we will be here. And
tickets on sale now.
Are they? Good. Yeah. AudrainConcord.com. Maybe if this is well-received, we could find a way to do it as a seminar during the show.
You're on the program.
It would be very fun. And I love Newport for car events. It's such a really cool place. I love the old things I see here, the buildings from 1700.
It's all you. Boats, it's great. Cars,
and now I have the houses. Outfit.
And now you've got the outfit.
Now
exactly.
I've got the outfit. And thank you to our live studio audience. We really appreciate you guys coming out to listen to us yap about cars for an hour.
And thank you for your questions. They were really insightful. Oh, wait, you didn't ask any.
Oh, do we have studio audience questions? Anyone want to get on? No? Yes?
No? Yeah. Shy all of a
Everyone
sudden?
Everyone wants to go
Holy
to dinner.
Holy cow.
I understand. Oh, one, yeah. Favorite car you've owned?
Favorite car that I have owned is probably my 308 GT4, actually. It was a car that made me smile and grin every time I drove it. I love that car.
It's a great car.
Yeah. Fantastic car. Yeah.
Mine is my Lamborghini Countach because it's the best car ever made.
Actually, the Lamborghini Islero was the best Lamborghini ever made. I had one of those.
I just did this road and track route to Vine, which is like a 3-day, you know, kind of a wine and luxury cars road trip thing. And a guy was signed up with an Islero, and I was so excited to see it. And then it broke, and he couldn't come. And he came in a BMW M3, and it was like, wah, wah.
Oh, Jesus, no.
But he was doing the copper state with it this week, which is why it was had to be fixed so urgently and couldn't come. So.
Early Lamborghinis are amazing cars.
Yeah, they're cool.
Absolutely astonishing cars. Yeah.
They're decently reliable, actually. They're pretty basic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's not a lot to them. Yeah. Love a classic Lambo.
Just lots of spark plugs and lots of oil.
Yeah. yeah, just have a drip tray. Yeah? Moz Donuts? The donut shop right around the corner.
Indeed. That's
a very Los Angeles donut shop, actually. I thought it was so LA. It was like being at home.
Yeah.
Because in LA, we've got all these independent donut shops. And if you haven't seen the documentary, The Donut King, I think it's on Netflix. I can't recommend it highly enough. If you come to LA, like there's no Dunkin' Donuts and there's no Krispy Kremes. It's all independently owned donut shops and they have really good donuts. And the reason for that is this Cambodian refugee came over in like the 60s, 70s, whenever Kissinger killed all those people. He came over and he learned how to make donuts, and he sponsored like 100 other families to come over and learn how to make donuts. And he leased them out shops so they would work at shops and then pay him rent. And he got super rich, and he bought an enormous house in Newport, California. He had a boat and like a huge pool and like all these, he was like having all these refugees like live in his house. And then he discovered Las Vegas. And this guy turned into a total degenerate gambler so fast and gambled all of his money away. And he had to get he basically got money by giving the people leasing his donut shops by giving them the shops. He'd get money for like pay his gambling debts, and then they own the shops. And so all these families and now their kids own all of these shops. And there's hundreds of shops all over LA. And Maz Donuts here in Newport, I think someone said the guy was like Portuguese.
Portuguese.
But it has exactly the same vibe as the Cambodian LA donut shops. Pretty good donuts.
So you've got
pretty good donuts.
Boats, great houses, great architecture,
shrimp,
the Audrain, and donuts.
And the shellfish here is not.
You're going to end up leaving LA and moving. You guys know how to eat in moving this town. To Newport. Newport's
I would love to have a summer home here. I like this town a lot. It's a great
they've got
town.
This little cottage called the Breakers.
Yeah.
I think you probably could make an offer on it.
Day rates, baby.
Yeah.
Day rates. Yeah. Crash at Jay's up the road.
He's got security.
I'll just get the Jay Leno wig and the denim shirt. There you go. And we'll be good to go.
Hey.
That's our show, folks. Thank you guys for coming out, and we appreciate it. And thanks to everyone at home.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thanks, Zach.
Thank you very much, Don. Thank you.
Good man. This guy rules. We love Donald Osborne. He's a great automotive, a great guardian of the automotive community here in Newport. You guys are lucky to have him on the payroll. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for coming out, everybody. We'll see you all later. That's our show.
Bye.